As we continue looking at this topic of divine disruption this morning, we are going to take a break from 1 Corinthians, and we're going to turn to Matthew chapter 2. So if you would mind opening your Bibles. Matthew 2. I'm going to read verses 1 through 16. Again, that's Matthew 2, beginning with verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem, Judea. For so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I call my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. So there was a young man who grew up in the world of politics, and at just the age of 25, the early age of 25, his father helped him to the position of governor. Over the next 10 years, he would act like a cornered raccoon trying to keep his position. There was family strife. In fact, once he rose to the governor's position, it was just a very brief time before his father, who helped him get there, was assassinated. There was war on pretty much all four borders of the land that he governed, as well as trying to deal with civil war that was going on within the borders. There were religious battles, and there were even a couple of attempts on his life that he was able to get past. But it all paid off. At the very early age of 35, he became king. And though a tyrant, he was really good at his job. In fact, he was so good that he was given the name Herod the Great. He was able for a time to keep peace where no one before him could really keep peace. He was successful in building all kinds of economic development. There were all sorts of fortresses that even stand today that were thanks to him. Probably his greatest achievement was the temple in Jerusalem. In fact, there's a historian that says that if you have not seen the temple in Jerusalem, you have never seen a beautiful building in your life. He was married to 10 different women and had children with all of them. And when they became of age, this is when a lot of his peace started going away. They all started vying for the crown. And though he was at this point very good at murder, he felt it necessary in these last few years to take out his prized wife, killing her, and taking out some of his sons because they all tried to get the crown. Well, he reigned for about 27 years. He began to wrestle after 27 years with chronic kidney disease. At least that's what they think he had. And this was complicated by a very, very uncomfortable case of maggot-infested gangrene. And I won't tell you where he had it. Just use your imagination. It sounded horrible. His days as king were numbered. In fact, his days on earth were numbered. And yet, he was willing to do anything to hang on to his crown. It was at this point when foreign dignitaries knock on his door. These dignitaries are called wise men in the Bible, we read. The term actually is magi. We have to speculate. Let me share just a little bit of speculation regarding these guys. One of the fun trivia questions around a Christmas table is always, parents, you can ask this, of course your kids are probably here too, how many of them were there? How many magi? How many wise men? We don't know. We say there's three. There's songs that say there's three. There's three gifts. Well, at least three different things that were given. So we come up with three, but we're not really sure. If you can picture, we know that these guys came from the east. There is a really good chance, maybe, that they came from Persia. And if you can remember years before, that's where Daniel was, along with a lot of his guys. And there's a good chance that they had the Jewish scriptures along with a whole bunch of other religious documents. And so these guys would have been studying it and known it very well. There is a chance that these guys entered town much more like Aladdin did, with a huge entourage of people. And there was no hiding the fact that they were wealthy. In fact, it made heads turn. And they knock on Herod's door. They walk in and they ask Herod, "Where is the king?" Now, we know from the text, and I don't want to necessarily get into studying the star, but we know that what happened wherever they came from the east, is that they saw a star or a heavenly body that appeared, and they realized in their studies that they had to go find what this star represented. And so we maybe see from Numbers 24:17, they may have come across this verse, "A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." Well, they knew maybe from the Jewish scriptures that they were seeking this prophesied king of the Jews. The text tells us that this took Herod by surprise, that he was greatly disturbed by the news. And we're not talking a surprise as if your birthday is coming up and you walk into a dark room and everybody yells surprise. The surprise that Herod feels, or the disturbance in this news, is immediately one of dread. Herod is filled with dread, hatred, just these abominable sorts of feelings. And he immediately thinks that he has to deal with this issue. Because we know that even on his deathbed, he would not abdicate his crown. So what does he do? He goes and he seeks the Jewish scholars, because he knows the word, he knows the Old Testament, but he doesn't know it as well as the scribes and the Pharisees, the guys who are writing these things down over and over and over again. They knew it well. So he goes and he asks them, what is going on with this king? When is he supposed to come? Where is he supposed to be born? All of these sorts of things. And so, again, I believe it was the children that recited it last week. They may have turned to Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And it's quoted even part of it here in the chapter we read. It says, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days." And we know his response eventually, once he finds out that it's the small town of Bethlehem, where there may have been, scholars think, between 15 to 30 young boys that were two and under, he decides, because if I can take out my own sons, why not take out other sons to remain king? He sends troops in, and every child that is two and under, that is a male, he murders. That's his response. Well, this morning, you and I, as far as I know, are not kings, and we are not queens. But we've spent most of our lives building a life for ourselves. I don't care how young you are working on this life. And this life that you're building, it includes things like family and relationships, job, home, land, things, possessions. It includes accounts and reputation. It even includes things maybe for some of us who are getting older in life, this thing called legacy that we can't seem to get out of our head. All of this stuff is this life that we're building. And frankly, at the end of all of it, even as we are in the middle of it, we want to be able to kind of go through the list and see what we have and see that it amounts to something. This little kingdom that we have worked so hard for, that we are willing to protect and that we rule over. And typically, everything runs rather smooth. There aren't a lot of hiccups, there aren't a lot of issues until one day someone confronts us, walks in and claims to rule over everything that you think is yours. There tends to be an issue with that. This is exactly what I'm calling the disruption of the king this morning. And I think that the text teaches us that you can respond in one of two ways. The first way is the way that we've seen Herod respond. And just think about this for a second. Again, as I try to paint the picture, imagine Herod is sitting on his throne or doing what he does as king, and all of a sudden this entourage comes and knocks on his door. How does he take the news? How would you take the news? He probably rolls his eyes in some regard and says, again, I'm so tired of this. I'm so tired of protecting what's mine. I'm sure he probably quickly responded, maybe even out loud, I'm the king. It's good to meet you. There's no other. It's all me. I'm the one with the power. I wear the crown. I'm the one that sits on the throne. If you want to be king, and someone else comes along saying that he is the king, then one of you has to give in. Only one person can sit on an absolute throne. There's no sharing. We see this and we know this by the wars that are going on even today. What I want to show and what I think we see, actually to be very clear from the text, honestly, is that Herod is a stark and scary example of the Bible's teaching that the source of the world's evil is every human heart. Herod's reaction to this king, Christ, this baby that has been born, is a picture of all of us. So the question is how? I would say that Christ as king claims absolute authority, the way all kings do. A summons to unconditional loyalty, which triggers, if you are honest with yourself, and I am honest with myself, it triggers deep resistance within my heart. Frankly, brothers and sisters, even as a believer, that's tough to sit sometimes. I don't like hearing that. Why? Because I want to sit on the throne. I want to rule. Selfishness and pride, desire, power, prestige. I want these things. And frankly, I don't want to share them. And if I'm honest with myself, I'll gladly allow God to be the advisor. I'll allow him to be an investor. Of course, he can invest in my life however he wants. I'll take anything he wants to give me. The blessings would be wonderful. I'll even maybe allow him to be a general, but not a king. He can help. He can provide, he can protect, but he cannot command, and he definitely can't control. And so the question, as we see that Herod is a great example of this, and I think our hearts we represent or we follow in Herod, the way Herod responds, is, I guess the question then is a very simple one, and it's for believers, in what areas of your life are you still king? Will you still not give up the throne? Are you still saying that when the king comes knocking, in a sense, and says, that throne is mine, you say, no. I'll tell you one very practical way, and this, you may have this taken care of, finished, and checked off, and everything's good in this part of your life. But one of the things that was really neat for the past 10 weeks that Jill and I were able to go through with some of the other couples that I see sitting out here is a financial class. And one of the things I never thought in a million years, because you hear it often, is this. How are you supposed to be obedient with your money? Give of the first fruits. Give 10%. And then the rest is yours. You worked hard for it. The Bible teaches more and more that as you study the Word of God, actually it all belongs to Him. And if He is King, then He owns every cent. And it matters how you spend your money. And I don't want to get on this tangent, but this was something for me where all of a sudden, what was interesting is I learned that I didn't even realize that I was the one sitting on the throne and not God in this particular example of my life. And so whenever it came to money, it was something where when the king came knocking, I simply shut the door, or I didn't hear it, or I just didn't even think about it. I wasn't willing. I wasn't ready. I like the comfort of having a little bit of a nest egg. And I like the comfort of having money when I need it and being able to spend it the way I want on the things I want. So what areas of your life are you still king? And in what ways are you fighting to remain in control? Well, that's Herod. We do have some positive in this story. And so the second way that we could respond is the way that the Magi respond. And so what is it that the Magi do? We learn, first of all, from verse 2. Verse 2 says, well, they ask a question, don't they? Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. The first thing the Magi do is they sought out the rightful king. And so I like both of those. I like the verb there, the fact that they left their land and they went and looked for. They went searching for. They sought after. Again, so many times in my life, I don't need to seek because I'm already here. I don't need to search for the one who rules. I just look in the mirror. But then this idea of the rightful king. And one of the neat things I like about this statement that they went and they searched and they found this star and all of this worked out. One of the neat things that's in here is that God reveals through the star the Christ child, the king. And so what's neat about these Magi is that they take the revelation of God and they pursue him as he is presented. They don't make Christ to be whomever they want or whatever they need. The correlation would be we go to the scriptures and we find out what the scriptures tell us about the king. And then we believe that and we follow that. Well, not only did they seek out the rightful king, but they worshipped by humbling themselves. Verse 10 says that they greatly rejoiced. And I love that statement. This reminds me of David when when there was a party going on in Jerusalem and they're just celebrating the Lord. And he actually strips down into his skivvies and dances. He humbles himself to the point where his wife is embarrassed and goes, "What? You're the king. What are you doing?" These Magi, in a sense, do the same thing. When they see the star appear again and they know where Jesus is, this idea of greatly rejoicing is the idea that they were shouting at the top of their lungs. They were literally dancing. Like the entourage they brought with them, they queued up the instruments and they started playing and they just party on the spot, which I'm sure Herod really enjoyed. They rejoiced greatly, not in themselves, but in the fact that the king was there and they were going to see him soon. And then verse 11. Verse 11 says, they fell down and worshipped him. They prostrated themselves. They humbled themselves. They bowed before the rightful king. What a neat picture. You have these magi that come from Persia. They're not even Israelites. And yet they are kingly-like. I don't think they were kings per se, but they were high up there. And what do? They lay down on the ground when they see the Christ child. They prostrate themselves. They put their faces in their hands on the ground. And then verse 11 goes on and says, then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. So not only do they fall down and they worship the king, but they open up their treasure chests and they give the king their treasures. And I don't want to get in necessarily to the three. I'm sure you've heard sermons that are all around the idea of the gold. And gold is a kingly metal, and frankincense, and that is used in sacrificing, and myrrh was used to embalm bodies. And so you have this neat picture of, you know, Christ and all his manhood and the idea that he's going to die and all of these other things, a kingly. I'd actually like to pull something else out of these three things. Just, again, just a little bit of a metaphor. I don't know if the Bible is explicitly teaching these things. But one of the things I love about the gold, the frankincense and the myrrh, but besides the fact that chances are, sovereignly, why God allowed them to give Mary and Joseph, Jesus, those things was because they were worth a lot of money. It would make the trek to Egypt much better. They could live in Egypt with a good bit of wealth until they came back. But one of the things that we see here with the gold really representing this idea of kings is the idea that when we give of our treasures, what do we do as servants? We are pretty much giving in the sense, in an act of knowing that we are not the king, that we give to the rightful king. And with this idea of frankincense, that when we give in a sense sacrificially and almost to the point where, well, again, it's all his. And all the treasures are his. But this idea of myrrh, then, is that we even, as the scriptures go on farther down in Matthew, that it says that we are supposed to then take up our cross and die to ourselves every moment of every day. And so I just like this idea of this metaphor of these three things that they bowed down before the rightful king and they worshiped him. And in their worship, they gave everything they were. They gave their identities. They gave their treasure. And then they gave their very lives. I think the good news this morning is that Christ the King wants to disrupt your life. And not to ruin it, but to transform it. He was and is a king like no other. The Son of God took on flesh and was born in a manger. He was crowned with thorns and lifted up on a cross. He was laid in a tomb, and 3 days later, he was resurrected. King Jesus ascended and sits at the right hand of God the Father, even now. But he offers salvation to all who come to him. How will you respond this morning? The king is coming, and he knocks on your door. Do you respond in the way that Herod did? And in every way possible, you scratch and you claw, and you make sure that you can stay in power, and you turn him away. Where will that get you? Or like the Magi, you can fall prostrate before him, and you can honor him with your treasures. One of the beautiful things that we learn as we study Jesus' life and his ministry and all that he has accomplished is that if we were to sort of change the metaphor just a bit, we could see this idea that really, if we took Herod as a king and the Magi as kings and then Christ as a king and just put them all together and sort of said, which one would you really like to serve? When you say no to Christ the King, then you have Herod really as your king. And boy, was he a tyrant. Sin and death is the one you bow to. And oh my goodness, how it will destroy your life. It will use and abuse you in every way possible and then throw you out in the end. But brothers and sisters, honestly, bowing to the Magi doesn't work either. To me, in my mind, and this might be a stretch for some of you as you look at this a little more seriously, but to me, what I put together with the Magi would simply just be bowing to religion. This idea of just, again, if I can just be good enough, if I can just make sure that, you know, the good outweighs the bad, pull out the scales and all of that stuff. And that doesn't work either. In fact, we see that what religion does is it points to the Christ child. That's what the Magi went looking for. Christ is the one that offers grace. Isn't it wonderful that we worship a king who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that has set aside his glory, that was born in a manger next to animals? The question this morning is, will you respond like Herod, or will you respond like the wise men? Seek the king while he may be found, Isaiah says. Call on him for salvation this morning. And when I say salvation, there are some of you that may not know the king at all, and you need him. You need him this morning. So seek him. The scriptures say that if you seek him while he may be found, he can be found. But brothers and sisters, those of you that know the king and have walked with the king, if you're anything like me, you struggle in this wrestling match with being able to very easily sing these songs and announce in prayer and even just say out loud, oh, yes, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And even this afternoon, I will go and I will claim that throne and wear that crown and say, no, you can't have this part of my life. And yet what he asks us to do is to trust him, to turn those points of our life, those wrestling matches, those things that we struggle with, over to him. And you know what he promises? It's neat. It's in the story. It ends. Is that what he will do is he will send you on a different path. That's what he did for the Magi. He sent them home on a different path. They didn't go home the same way. And what is so brilliant about the gospel is that the gospel changes, transforms our lives to the point where we are never the same people again. So more and more, and you know this, because you've done it if you're a believer, as you give things over to the king, he transforms and changes you so that you can constantly and consistently be on a different and better path, closer and closer and closer to your Savior. So it is my prayer this morning that, like the Magi, all of us together will seek after the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And that when we find him, we will bow prostrate to him and trust him with everything we are. And that he will do what he does, and that is transform us and make us more and more like him. And that will be enough. That will be enough. That will satisfy our longings and our deepest desires. Let's pray.